So I have to start off with a correction. Probably some of you will have spotted the deliberate mistake. It's not that I got the Chaitadharmas wrong, I got a literary reference wrong. I actually thought I'd said that I'd referred to Portrait of an Artist as a Young Man, but apparently the words "The Dubliners" came out of my mouth. But there we are. I'm sorry, I apologise profusely to the Irish. I know how sensitive this issue is. And I claim the right of an Irish grandmother. So today we're going to start examining the ethically determined Chaitadharmas. You remember there are 37 of them. There's the 11 Kushala Chaitadharmas, the 6 Mula Kleshas, and the 20 Upaklesas. The Kushala Chaitadharmas are the skillful mental events. The Mula Kleshas are the fundamental or root defilements or afflictions. And the Upaklesas are the secondary or derived afflictions. So we're going to be looking at each of those. We're going to be looking at groupings of Kushala, Klesha, and Upaklesha Chaitadharmas, ones that belong together. And today we're going to be looking at Shraddha and Ashraddha, Hri and Ahrikya, Apatrapya and Anapatrapya. So we're going to be looking at 3 Kushala Chaitadharmas, Shraddha, Hri, and Apatrapya. The Kushala Chaitadharmas are said, of the 11 of them, it's said that 10 are present in all skillful mental states. So whenever you have a good mind, as it's called, a skillful chitta, 10 of those will be present at least in potentiality. So for instance, you're not going to experience Hri if you've not done something wrong. But as soon as the potential for acting unskillfully comes into your mind, or an unskillful thought occurs, it's swept away by Hri and Apatrapya. So all 10 are present, or at least to hand, whenever there's a skillful chitta. This is something that we'll be exploring in meditation, because if you are experiencing an uplifted and positive state, well, you will be able to fairly easily detect at least 10 of those mental states. One of them, the 11th, Prashrabdi, is generally said only to be found in a dhyanic state, although some authorities, one or two of them, say that that too is found even in the non-dhyanic state. So anyway, that's something to bear in mind. When we're dealing with the Kushala Chaitadharmas, they are within one's experience whenever one is experiencing anything that is at least to some extent positive or skillful. So we know all of these states, and we probably dwell in them quite a lot of the time, even if in a quite dilute or weak way. So to the extent that the mind is skillful, 10 of those will be near at hand, let's put it that. Now, of the Kushala Chaitadharmas, the first in the listing and the most fundamental is Shraddha. And Shraddha, again, we remember, is present in all wholesome chittas. Whenever there's a Kushala chitta, Shraddha is there. That is unequivocally there. It's not like Hri, which is sort of ready to be there. Shraddha is implicit in any positive mental state. So what is Shraddha? It's the capacity latent in all consciousness to respond to value. It's one's capacity to respond to value. And it is latent in all consciousness. It's not that some people are born with a capacity and others are not. There's something about consciousness itself which means that it has a capacity to respond to value. It's natural and intuitive. That's what I'm getting at when I'm saying it's latent and inherent in all consciousness. It's not something you think into being, although thought may be an aid to its arising. It's a direct, natural and intuitive response of the mind, of the heart, to the to value. I'm putting it at the moment in that broadest and, in a sense, most weak term. It manifests in different areas of our life. For instance, I think that Shraddha is connected to the aesthetic sense, one's response to beauty. It's also found in an ethical response, one's response to virtue in others. You see somebody acting nobly, and you respond to that. Well, that, it seems to me, is an aspect of faith, or an aspect of the faculty which, in its most full and specific sense, is faith. It's the basis for friendship, at least in the highest sense. It's our friendship diverts from our response to the virtue in the other and their response to the virtue in us. So what is it that responds? It's this capacity which in its most developed form is Shraddha. It's one's response to the truth when you hear it. Whether truth in the mundane sense, you hear somebody confessing, speaking the truth. You respond to it. You know they're speaking the truth. Or when you hear the truths told in some higher sense, when you hear the Dharma taught, for instance, and taught with genuine understanding, you respond. And that response, I suggest, is connected with Shraddha, or Shraddha is its most specific and developed form. So in this most specific and developed form is the response to spiritual values. Those spiritual values, of course, will be found in people. People will embody those values to a greater or lesser extent. It'll be found in the words that they use to communicate their understanding, communicate the Dhamma. It'll be found in images which embody the truth, that embody the ideals. It'll be found in visionary experience. All of those are objects which, as it were, can be targets for faith. It's the sort of thing that probably most of us experienced when we first came across the Dharma in one form or another. For some people, even just looking at an image arouses faith. For others, listening to somebody talking the Dhamma will arouse faith. In some, it may be a noble person who themselves is committed to the Dharma. That may arouse faith. I suppose the equivalent in the Buddha's life was seeing the ascetic after having seen the three preliminary sights. So faith is our response to something that embodies the spiritual ideal. Xuan Sung talks of the objectives of faith, the objects of faith, in terms of three things: realities, qualities, and capacities. So realities are truths, especially the truth of conditionality, the truth of the karma, of karma, in his account. It the ultimate nature of things, as expressed in the words of the Dharma. So faith responds to realities. You know that they are true. You intuitively, instinctively almost, you may say, respond to them as true. It's response to qualities. So the qualities of the Buddha, the qualities, for instance, that the Buddha image may communicate, may convey, are the virtues, the qualities that individuals you come into contact with do display. It's a kind of spiritual and ethical radiance. And faith is a response to that radiance, a response to the qualities that emanate from the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and members of the Sangha and the truth. Then finally, it's a response to capacities. You see that the Dharma is not just something distant from you, but something latent within you. You see that the truth is latent within you, that Buddhahood is latent within you. So you respond to it not just as something far above you, but as something to which you are connected from your own capacity. You respond to the potentiality of individuals, including yourself, to realise the highest that is possible. So faith is faith in realities, qualities, and capacities. The response is a total one. It's not just that you have a kind of intellectual conviction, or that you're very strongly moved and attracted and pleased by the pleasurable aspects of the ideal, or that you feel a sort of commitment. It's a total response of the whole being. It's not just an aspect of citta. Shraddha, so to speak, colours the whole mind, so that every aspect of your being is to a greater or lesser extent involved in that response. And in fact, that could be said to be one of its primary characteristics. It's a total response of the of all the energies which move towards, respond to the ideal. So we can look at this in terms of the cognitive, affective or emotional and volitional. Cognitively, faith is a deep conviction in realities. This is called, in tradition, the deep faith. There are three terms that are often used in the Pali Canon and that then are kind of dogmatized in later tradition. There's deep faith, lucid faith, and longing faith. Some of you will know these become very, very important in Shinran, who is really the sort of master of faith. So, anyway, first of all, there's deep faith, which represents the cognitive dimension, and which is a deep conviction in realities, in Xuanzang's terms. Realities as realized by the Buddha, as expressed in the Dhamma, and as followed by the Sangha. So, truths, if you like, things that you perceive to be actually existing, to be the real nature of things. I think it's very interesting that that faith can be approached from this cognitive point of view, because, of course, in our Western traditions, that is, in Christianity at least, faith is predominantly an emotional experience. That's the way it's predominantly spoken of. And in a sense, you're asked to lay aside your cognition, your intellect. Whilst one can see there's some sense in that, because faith is not a thinking. It is at the same time in Buddhism a knowing, and I personally consider this to be extremely important. Faith is a sort of foreshadowing of insight. It is essentially the same faculty as insight. Shraddha, taken far enough, is prajna. So initially, your response to the truth, your response to realities, your knowing the truth of those realities, is intuitive. You've not fully sort of absorbed and grasped it. It's not an essential sort of part of your being. It's a response, but it is a knowing. So your faith does involve a conviction, and that conviction is, from a traditional point of view, well founded. Of course, to begin with, the cognitive dimension of faith, your response to the truth, is a bit uncertain. You know you can be fooled, you know you can be taken in, you know that you don't fully understand, so that your faith needs to be tested by reason and by experience. You need to examine your faith. You need to examine that sort of intuitive cognition in the light of reason. You have to see whether it adds up within itself, so to speak, whether it's consistent with what you know, whether it's consistent with traditional teaching. And you have to see whether it's consistent with experience. All of this, of course, is gone into in the Survey of Buddhism. It's a very good exploration of faith from this point of view, from the three points of view of intuition, reason, and experience. So the cognitive dimensions of faith, the response to the truth, or the realities that the Dhamma conveys, or the Buddha expresses, and that the Sangha aspires to, needs to be tested. But it is there. And faith, as it becomes stronger, becomes more and more sure. You know more and more clearly that what you are, so to speak, understanding by means of intuitive faith is the truth, finally speaking. So that eventually Shraddha becomes prajna. So emotionally, faith is the emotional aspect of faith is the lucid faith, which is quite an interesting way of putting it. And the lucid faith is a serene confidence and attraction to the qualities of the three jewels. It's sort of aesthetic. It's a taking pleasure in those qualities. So again, it's intuitive. It's direct. And it's delightful. It's taking delight in those qualities of the Buddha. It's pasado. You feel a strong sort of attraction and delight in this wonderful radiance that the three jewels shed, and that those who are themselves committed to the three jewels shed. So it's yes, it's an emotional experience. It's an aesthetic experience, you could almost say. A taking pleasure in, a taking delight in these wonderful qualities, which you feel very strongly moved by and drawn towards. It's spoken of as lucid and serene, which I find very interesting, because it's said that this aspect of faith gives a great sense of clarity and calmness and solidity. You feel just very happy and balanced and poised. It's as if everything's been sorted out. You know what the focus of things is. You know which way up the universe is. And therefore you feel very relaxed, very happy, very calm. I remember this very, very strongly myself on the first times I did the prostration practice. And I remember having a series of dreams in which everything sort of fell into place around Padmasambhava, as it was at that time. As if... you know, up to that point, my universe had been a chaos. But because there was a response of faith, there was a source of value. Everything arranged itself around that focus of value. And that did give a great sense of lucidity and serenity, of calmness, of happiness, of confidence. And it's a humble confidence. You feel an intense faith in the ideals, and a sort of happiness in your own relationship with them. But it's not an arrogant faith or an arrogant confidence at all. Volitionally, faith is the longing faith, a longing to fulfill the promise that you see before you. It's a strong urge to realize the spiritual potential that you are convinced you have. It's not just that you feel drawn towards the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, but you're convinced that you can make it, you can get there, you can approach and realize for yourself those spiritual ideals. This is, of course, an extremely important aspect of faith. Without that, faith is mere sort of devotion. It's where you admire something from a distance, but feel, in a certain sense, it's beyond you, God and man. So in faith in Buddhism, what's absolutely important is that you do recognize how much that ideal goes beyond you, but at the same time, you realize fully that you can attain it. So it's a sort of double-sided experience, both of awe, you could say, but also a sort of confidence, a determination. So these make up faith, a total response of head, heart and legs, as you move, if you see what I mean. I think it's also important not to think of faith too much in kind of superficial emotional terms. I've often thought myself, you know, at times I kind of wondered, well, you know, do I really have any faith? I'm not feeling intensely inspired at the moment. I'm not feeling absolutely uplifted about going into the shrine room in the morning or something like that. And, you know, you sort of think, well, where's my faith? And then you think about it and you realise, well, you are walking to the shrine room and you've been doing it for many years and you're going to go on doing it, almost despite yourself. And you realise that faith actually is a sort of subterranean feeling, or not a feeling at all. Again, I remember a very strong experience waking up one morning just with the remnants of a dream in my mind, which just amounted to the words, feelings deeper than you can feel. And I realised what it was referring to was faith. The sort of undercurrent of my being, the orientation of my being, which often was belied by the superficial turbulence and so on. So it's a deep orientation of being, and it shows itself in where you're going rather than in what you're immediately feeling. Of course, if you dig into what you're immediately feeling, you probably come across that fundamental faith, that fundamental orientation. And of course, at times you'll have wonderful experiences of that deep faith manifesting in strong feelings of devotion, of bhakti. But bhakti itself is not necessarily faith, shraddha. You can have lots and lots of bhakti, but no shraddha. Well, the Indians will know this. You see people at shrines by the wayside, at pieces of red-coloured stone, and they're obviously full of bhakti, but there's no shraddha in the Buddhist sense, at least. Bhakti can be very enjoyable, it's very pleasurable, very beautiful, but it's not faith. At the same time, faith often manifests in devotion, and the expression of devotion can help to strengthen and channel faith. Faith is also, it's not just that it's deep, it's calm, and of course it gives confidence to one's life as a whole. I've already spoken of this, really. Because you've got an orientation, because you know which way up the world is, you feel great confidence. Everything falls into place. You know where everything belongs. It's an orientation in that literal sense. It's a facing to the east in the classical Western parlance and Islamic. You're oriented. You know where the centre is. The centre is in the Buddha. The Buddha is, therefore, the source of all value. Everything for a Buddhist comes from the Buddha. All value comes from the Buddha. Faith also purifies the mind. It purifies the mind because, of course, it drives out the negative. First of all, it drives it out by making it painfully obvious. In the light of your faith, the darkness of your evil and unskillfulness is exposed. But then the power of faith purifies. So in that sense, it's Vajrasattva's nectar, which pours down into you, exposing more fully all the blackness of your evil deeds, but also purifying, washing away. But it purifies also in the sense that it introduces order and clarity into your mind, because you know which way up everything is and what the focus is. So the effect of faith is to calm and clarify, purify, and to give a general confidence in your actions. Finally, it should be said that faith tends to action. It tends, in the classical expression, this is Nagarjuna's expression, it leaps forward. It leaps forward towards its objective. It's not just a sort of a passive worship from a distance. It's a commitment. It eventuates in commitment, so that going for refuge to the three jewels is the active dimension of shraddha. It's the volitional dimension of shraddha put into effect. So it's a very, very beautiful and deep and far-reaching quality, which we experience most fully in our response to the three jewels, but finds its place on every level. Really, the Buddhist insight, the Abhidhamma insight, that shraddha is present in all skillful mental states gives rise to is the realization that for people who know nothing about Buddhism, people who have no sort of system of ideals that they explicitly commit themselves to, do respond to something higher to some extent. When you commit a selfless act, when a so-called ordinary person, commits a selfless act. Well, there's some shraddha there. There's some sort of response to a higher ideal. It's not mere self-preservation, but it's a response to the other person, which requires some sort of self-negation. And that implies a kind of virtue or ideal. So shraddha manifests to some extent in a diffuse and non-specific way in all sorts of contexts. Buddhists do not have a monopoly of shraddha. Of course, Buddhists give shraddha a particular understanding and a particular focus, which inevitably we consider to be probably the most clear and deep expression of the human ideals. But those ideals are represented to a greater or lesser extent in every decent human action. So I think it's quite important to realise that, because that also sort of accentuates our affinity with all good people, if you like, and the good in all. There's a touch of shraddha in every good action, even if it is not explicit, even if it does not have the depth and range that is implied by the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. And after all, most of us, most of the time, are not at that depth and range anyway. Now, if you don't have shraddha, you have something else. It's not merely that you don't have shraddha. You have an actual presence of something else. You have ashraddha. In Buddhist Abhidhamma psychology, it's said that negative factors are positive, if you see what I mean. That the absence of something is in itself a presence. Hope you can see what I mean. It sounds nice and zen, doesn't it? So, when you have not got shraddha, you've actually got ashraddha, which is the opposite of faith, the absence of faith, non-faith. And ashraddha has all the characteristics, the negation of all the characteristics of shraddha. It's a lack of conviction about realities. So you just do not really believe in anything that is even approximates to the truth. It's a lack of attraction to qualities. You do not respond to higher qualities, whether they are explicitly Buddhist or not. And you lack aspiration and confidence in your own aspiration. Probably, for many of us, we're more likely to feel a sort of an ashraddha that consists in lack of aspiration than an ashraddha that consists in lack of conviction or lack of attraction. We may be convinced, we may be attracted, but we may not believe that we can do it. We may fall into despair, we may fall into the attitude that, well, it's all very well, those ideals are very wonderful, they're very lofty, but in a sense they've got nothing to do with me, they're way beyond me. And quite a lot of discussion is had on this this tendency to despair. It's especially dwelt upon in the Mahayana, because the Mahayana places the ideal so loftily, you know, the enlightenment of all sentient beings and so on and so forth, that inevitably you realise you just cannot do it. And so you very easily then fall into thinking, well, what's the point? What's the use? What's that got to do with me? Well, you remember in the Ratnaguna Samchayagata that the Buddha talks of the ideal bodhisattva as being one who does not tremble when he hears the mother's deep truths, when he hears the ultimate nature of things enunciated. He doesn't think, this has got nothing that I can relate to, nothing I can do. So probably for many of us, the despair of lack of confidence in our own abilities is the way in which we'll experience faith most readily, lack of faith most readily. And of course, that then quickly leads on to lack of conviction and lack of attraction itself. You begin to sort of give up and to turn your back on ideals, on values at all, let alone on the three jewels. So ashraddha is this failure to have any kind of conviction about the ultimate nature of things, about the truth of things, failure to have any attraction to good qualities, even, as it were, ordinary good qualities. You're just not attracted to them, you're not bothered by them. It's the sort of state of mind where somebody is just completely cynical about somebody acting well. I remember once when we were working at Sukhavati, one of the people we used to buy things from coming to me and I'd become aware that some of the goods we were getting were not altogether legally come by. So I was explaining to him, now look, Bobby, we can't take anything that's stolen. But first of all, he tried to do a bit of Abhidhamma, and he said, they're not stolen, they're just a bit tropical. Anyway, I said, well, we're not even interested in the tropical. And he looked at me with pity in his eyes, and he said, look, Bootsy, that's what I used to be called in these days, look, Bootsy, you can't live like that. So, sort of no recognition of qualities, if you see what I mean. There's just complete cynicism about them. A rather refreshing sort of honesty, but that's about it. And yes, then finally a lack of aspiration, a lack of conviction in your own abilities, your own powers. And ashradhya leads to a mind that's muddy and dull, that's lazy. You don't know which way everything is. You haven't got a way to evaluate things, so your mind is slow and dull and lazy. You don't feel like making much effort. And yes, there's no response to value. It can even be, of course, a definite aversion to value, a nihilistic denial of value, a cynicism about value, so that you just reject it. You even laugh at it. You despise those who have ideals, who have values. Of course, it can also be an active espousal of false views, of false values. It can, and in this sense, I think it is very much very destructive. It can also be a sort of halfway. You can have a genuine response to values, but at the same time, you're responding to them in the wrong kind of way. There's not just a straightforward response of faith. There's also a need. You want something to believe in. You want somebody to look after you. You want something to give up responsibility to, and so on. So faith can be a kind of a foolish trust, which is not really tested, not really thought about, not really touched. The ideals to which you commit yourself. And this, of course, is something that most of us have come across in ourselves, because when we become Buddhists, we open ourselves up to ideals which we haven't fully realised. So we often have to do quite a bit of sorting out and sifting to find the genuine within all the other kinds of responses that we have. Of course, ashradhya isn't just a sort of individual experience, it becomes a collective experience, just as Shraddha become a collective experience. You experience, for instance, a context like this, an environment of Shraddha, that you know that others share the Shraddha that you have, share the ideals and the feelings that you have for those ideals and the convictions you have about them with you, so that you feel, well, you can share yourself more fully. But often in other contexts you feel you can't share that aspect of yourself beyond a certain basic level. And of course, being in an environment which is in which ashradhya predominates also undermines your own shraddha. And I think it could be said that our own present culture is predominantly one of ashradhya, although of course there are many features of shraddha in at least in the broadest sense. But you just have to walk around any shopping mall or something like that to realise there's a complete absence of any evocation or expression of a higher dimension to life. And that is the world we live in. So, that's Shraddha and Ashraddha, which are absolutely basic to all good minds. And they are present within all good minds. Sorry. Shraddha is present within all good minds. I hope I haven't led anybody astray there. And ashradhya is present in all bad minds. Bad in the literal sense, not in the modern inverted sense. So then we come to Hri and Upatrapya, which follow from Shraddha. You have a sense of values, you have a sense of ideals, you have a sense of how you should be, how you should act. You have ethical standards for yourself. When you fall short of those values, you feel shame, you feel remorse. You feel that painful consciousness of having fallen short. Yes, you actually feel uncomfortable, and that can be physically expressed. You can you blush. You feel hot. You feel like not looking at people. You don't want to look people in the eyes because you feel ashamed. So it's a definite, direct bodily experience of painful consciousness. So if you have that painful consciousness, that shame, and you've developed it to any extent and you've prized it, well, it will be a guardian for you, because it will prevent you from acting unskillfully, because you won't want to experience it. So as a result of cultivating that painful consciousness, you're protected from acting unskillfully, and when you do act unskillfully, you're assisted in putting it right, in restituting what you've done. So that painful consciousness, that kakrutya, becomes a kind of moral guardian. But there are two different ways in which that kakrutya, that remorse, is triggered. And these two are what give us the difference between Hri and Upatrapya. Hri is the first, and that is where your shame is triggered by your personal conscience. You have ideals, you have a moral sensitivity, you have when you act unskillfully, is sort of offended, and therefore gives rise to a feeling of pain. Because you've got an ideal that you hold in self-respect, not on behalf of anybody else, not out of fear or anything like that, but you hold it in full self-respect. When that is transgressed by you, you feel it, and that is Hri. Hri also has another dimension. You have respect for the Dharma, and you have a personal commitment to living in accordance with the Dharma. So you may not immediately sense that what you've done is wrong, but because you know the Dharma teaches that it's wrong, and you respect the Dharma, then you feel that painful consciousness of wrongdoing. So Hri is triggered, is shame triggered, either by your inner idealism, your inner self-respect, your inner moral dignity, or it's triggered by your love and devotion to the Dharma and your consciousness that you've broken the Dharma. So the precepts would be the primary embodiment of the Dharma in this respect. You may not yourself immediately feel that what you've done is wrong, but because you're trying to practice the precepts, you have faith in the precepts as a representation of the ideal of what the Buddha would be, then you feel ashamed that you've let your own commitment to the Three Jewels down. So Hri comes independence on yourself, it's said. Upatrapya comes independence on others. You've got great respect for other people as embodiments, or to somewhat greater extent than you, of commitment to the ideals. So somebody else, some other people, become the embodiments for you of spiritual ideals, spiritual principles, and especially of ethical standards. You know they're not perfect, but they become for you the inspirers of moral effort. You've got faith in them, in other words. So that leads one to feel shame when you do something which you know they would regard as unskillful. It doesn't matter whether they do know what you've done or not. The point is that you feel, when you've done it, oh, if Bhante knew about that, he would feel that was not a good thing to do. And through that, your own moral sense is triggered. It's as if you haven't got immediate access to it, but through your consciousness of them and your consciousness of their moral standards, your own is sparked off. That is apatrapia. It's not out of fear of them. Sometimes it's translated as fear of blame. But I think that's very poor indeed and very misleading. It's not that you think they'll reject you or anything like that. It's just that you think, well, they will think of me as somebody who's acted like that. You want them to think well of you, not, you know, sort of infantile desire for approval, but because they, for you, represent the ideal which you're trying to live up to yourself. So out of regard for them, you could even say, you don't want to subject themselves to the experience of seeing you acting unskillfully. I think this is quite important to get clear. I touched on it a bit yesterday. It's so easy for us to get moral feelings mixed up with pseudo-moral feelings, which are based in often in our religious training and in our early childhood experiences and so forth. So neurotic guilt masquerades as genuine moral sense. So it's quite important that we get this clear. But we must also be very careful not to throw out the baby with the bathwater. The baby of apatrapia with the bathwater of fear of being rejected. Have I got that right? I've got to be so careful now. I don't know what I'm saying. I think that often we do that because we don't want to feel neurotic guilt, because we don't want to feel influenced by our desire to please others. We don't allow ourselves to be influenced by our regard for others. I think this is quite common amongst us, and something I think that we need to address, because my impression is that apatrapia is a much more powerful moral motivator than kri is, because kri, well, you can always slide round your kri. Well, I can. But apatrapia, it's much more difficult, because there is a physical embodiment of the ideal for you. And we are pack animals. We're creatures of community. We exist in relation to other people. We're very strongly influenced by what other people do and think and so on. So I think that probably, if we're really honest, we'll have to admit that we're much more influenced by other people than we like to realise. It's quite interesting. I wouldn't have to say this sort of thing in India, because there in India people don't mind being influenced by other people. They're much more accustomed to it, perhaps even a bit too accustomed to it at times. So everything is the obverse of here. But here people don't want to be influenced by others. I did it my way. But yes, I think myself, I've come to realise that apatrapia is a very, very powerful aid and tool in my spiritual development, and one that I need to exercise much more fully and be proud of, be happy about, feel, wonderful, I've felt some apatrapia. So they need to be cultivated. Both kri and apatrapia need to be cultivated. They're positive mental events. That's interesting in itself, because it's they're positive mental events, but they're painful experiences. We so often identify the positive with the pleasant and the painful with the negative. But positive experiences can be painful, and negative experiences, of course, can be pleasurable. But yes, kri and apatrapia are positive mental events, even though they involve a painful consciousness. Of course, eventually they become an extreme ethical sensitivity, so that you only have to approach the mere possibility of acting unskillfully, and they come into play, and they defend you, so to speak. And that's why they're the two lokapalas. I came across a remarkable quotation in Hesiod, in Works and Days. I hope I'm getting my quotations right. In which Hesiod speaks of the age of iron, the last age and the decay of mankind. And he speaks of two goddesses with veiled faces ascending the mountain away from mankind. And the two goddesses are Nemesis and Eidos. I might not have that quite right, but I think it's Eidos. They seem pretty clearly to amount to kri and apatrapia. Hesiod gives this image of the moral decline of the Age of Iron, in which there is no shame, in which there is no care about others' thoughts and feelings, no nemesis. And in this way, the Greek tradition, which we are after all the heirs of, has the same kind of conception. I'd like to find out much more about that. Maybe others, any Greek scholars, could look it up and clarify it. So, these two guard the world. They keep us acting morally. And we need to deliberately bring them into play and make them an active part of our life, especially through confession. Confession is the way in which we make our consciences tender. By expressing our remorse, we enable ourselves to feel remorse more. If we don't express remorse, it hardens. A sort of carapace grows over it, a scab grows over it, so that we're less and less able even to feel remorse. But if we express our remorse, if we give expression to Hriya and Apatrapya, they get stronger and stronger. Myself, I've felt that the chapter is one of the best and primary arenas for the development of remorse and for getting Hriya and Apatrapya more firmly into place, especially Apatrapya. You may not decide that your chapter members are all, you know, moral exemplars to you, but sort of taken as a whole, they represent a weight and depth of commitment that you can respect and that you can look up to, that you can feel ashamed in relation to. So I've personally been trying to cultivate a strong sense of Apatrapya in relation to my chapter, because, well, it's very hard to find other contexts where you can act it out. I mean, I feel that in relation to Bhante, but I can't go and speak to him every time I act unskillfully. He's very fortunate that I don't try. So we can use our chapters in this way to develop Hri and especially Apatrapya, to make our consciences more tender and therefore to give our moral lives a much stronger basis. Asanga speaks of Hri and Apatrapya as the essence of ethics. So the opposite of Hri and Apatrapya are Ahrikya and Anapatrapya, shamelessness. Ahrikya is lack of conscience. You don't have any aspiration, you don't have any ideal, so you don't feel ashamed when you let yourself down. Well, in a sense, you haven't let yourself down. You ignore any feelings of remorse that you do chance to have, and so you cease to feel them. You have no respect for the Dharma, so you don't feel remorse when you break the precepts. So you don't apply the Dharma to your life. You don't apply the precepts to your life. So ahrikya is where you lack conscience. You lack respect for the Dharma. You lack a moral sense. You even have an anti-moral sense. Evil be thou my good. You start to think in terms of acting unskillfully as acting skillfully. I think we can get into this when we're in a sort of phase of moral rebellion, trying to get rid of false senses of remorse. We can often go to the other extreme and be actually doing things that are morally reprehensible, but as a sort of, with a moral justification, it's good for my development. We used to get that, maybe we don't get it anymore. But anyway, ahrikya is this failure to have any moral sense, even a deliberate dousing of one's moral sense, even an inversion of one's moral sense, so that you gloat, you glory in acting unskillfully. I remember recently I was with some relations, and one of them was a relatively young man. He was saying to me, he said to me, "God, last night I was pissed as a skunk." And I just, you know, I'm sort of not quite used to that sort of thing, and I've forgotten what my response was supposed to be. And, you know, I looked a little concerned, as it were. And he said, "That's the trouble with you religious people, you're so po-faced." He was really proud of being pissed as a skunk. The Indians can find out what that means later. But that is ahrikya, where you're really pleased about doing something that really is... Well, he probably wasn't doing anything terribly bad, he's just making a fool of himself, but probably making a fool of other people too. So that's ahrikya. Ahrikya is present, I stress, brothers, in every unskillful action. To some extent, whenever you act unskillfully, you have some shamelessness. There's some residual consciousness often of the unskillfulness of what you're doing, but you sort of say to yourself,
there. So what? You kind of cock a snook at your moral sense and you just say, yeah, look what I'm doing. And you, it can even be quite conscious in that sort of way, or semi-conscious, and you feel a sneaking sort of pride in it. Well, this is pretty perverse, and we won't go into it any further. Anapatrapya is the same, but when related to other people. You don't respect others. You don't care what they think. You know, you can sense to some degree that they're worthy people, but you don't care. And maybe even after a while you stop even seeing them as worthy people. So you don't respect them, you don't offer them any respect. You may even get to the point where you like to shock or upset them. You want to do something that they will not consider to be a positive thing. So yes, shamelessness in both these forms is present in all unskillful action. It's the deliberate flouting of conscience, somewhere we know we've done wrong, but we do it anyway, and even rejoice in it. So there's this moral battleground. There's an impetus to act skillfully and not to act unskillfully. And there's an impetus to do what sort of gives us immediate gratification, albeit unskillful, maybe. So we need all the help we can get to strengthen our conscience, to strengthen our moral sense. And as I say, my own experience is that often free is not enough. I can sort of rationalise my way around it, or ahrikya is a bit stronger at times. And I think it's particularly true when you're kind of on your own, when nobody can see what's going on, or you know, when you're with other people but they can't see what's going on in your brain. This involves what I started to refer to in looking at myself, the ethics of the private moment. Nobody can see what you're up to, so you do those often rather minor, unskillful things, but because there's nobody else present, you can sort of work your way around to do them. And I think a lot of the sort of deepening of spiritual life involves opening up those private areas and moments to other people, so that you begin to get into them, to make them, objectify them and transform them under the impetus of apatrapya. You need to call on apatrapya, especially, as I said, because it's usually more powerful than hri, the effect of others on us being so very strong. So yes, I think that this is why it's important to develop a confessional element in chapters, if one wants to. It's a way of bringing apatrapya into play, and if you want to get to grips with those private areas, those areas that hri is not strong enough to get to, apatrapya gets to the parts that hri cannot get to. And where you need to find ways of activating apatrapya, because hri is sort of, it solely depends on your own spontaneous responses. So there we are, we've dealt with shraddha and its opposite, ashraddha, hri and its opposite, ahrikya, and apatrapya and its opposite, anapatrapya. And they are really the most important of the kushala chaita dharmas. All the others follow on from them and are modalities of them in a certain sense. These three are so important because they're the basis of spiritual and moral life. I know that Nagarjuna, for instance, says that shraddha is more important than prajna, because without shraddha there's no prajna. But prajna on its own, well, you can't have. So shraddha is therefore more important because it's it comes first. You don't get prajna until you've had shraddha. So in this sense, shraddha is the whole basis of the spiritual life. It's what motivates you. It's the skillful chetana, it's chanda, dhammachanda, that drives you forward on the path. Hri and apatrapya are those two moral guardians that keep you on the path, that alert you when you stray, when you betray your shraddha, when you fall short of the ideal that you've set yourself. Hri and apatrapya give you that painful consciousness that you've done wrong, that you've done less than you could have done. You've been unworthy of what you've aspired to. So that's it for today. Tomorrow we're going to deal with two groupings. We're going to deal with alopa, and the klesha and upaklesha that are identified with that, and advesha and the kleshas and upakleshas associated with that. Alopa is non-craving, and it's the direct counter of raga, which is craving, or passion in that sense, and of the upakleshas, matsarya, which is avarice, mraksha, which is slyness, concealment, maya, which is hypocrisy, and shatya, which is deceit. So alopa, raga, matsarya, mraksha, maya, and shatya. Then advesha, which is non-hatred, the kushala chaitadharma of non-hatred, is the counterpart of pratigha, which means literally anger, but really it's hatred. And the upakleshas of krodha, rage, upanaha, resentment, prajasha, spite, and irsya, envy. So it's going to be a happy morning tomorrow. We're going to be looking at probably some things with which we're all too familiar. But of course we're also familiar with alopa and advesha. But we have to deal with the beasts as well as the beauties.